Sion, one of the common themes in all of your novels, at least the three that I've read, is how you mix ancient Icelandic history and folk stories with what I would call magic realism, or maybe you would call it surrealism. Do you see a connection between surrealism and these old folk stories?
Yes, I very much do. And I think I am mainly influenced by the Icelandic sagas, the medieval grand narratives that were written in Icelandic in the 13th, 14th century Iceland. Because in those you have, on one hand, descriptions of, well, let's call it everyday life, even though it includes killings and Viking raids and whatnot. But in those narratives, you have, on one hand, realistic descriptions of people and their actions and their words. And on the other hand, you have descriptions of dreams. You have poetry that people tend to compose at very dramatic moments. and you have sometimes have the gods interfering. And this is all represented as one reality.
So it's not as if the more everyday kinds of things are considered real and the other is sort of dreamy. It's all considered real.
It's all considered one reality, and it's the reality that the human being is living. And with this heritage, it comes very easy for me to bring together in my books different levels of reality.
So, and one of those levels of reality is then your interest in the more recent artistic tradition of surrealism. How did you get interested in this?
Well, as a kid, I was first interested in the folk stories. And there was an element of the bizarre in the folk stories that I think prepared me for surrealism, fall for surrealism when I was a teenager. And in the Icelandic folk stories, you have so many strange things happening. And one of my favorite folk stories is the story of the furry trout, which is an animal that looks exactly like a normal trout, but you should be quite careful with it when you're fishing, because if a furry trout is eaten by a male, that male falls pregnant. And, okay, that's strange that somebody falls pregnant, yes. But it only becomes a problem in the ninth month when that man has to give birth. And in those stories, there were quite graphic and accurate descriptions of how to solve that. And they said simply, you take the man, you put him on a table, you spread his legs, you take a sharp knife and you open up his scrotum, and you go in and you fetch the child. And, you know, for a 9-year-old, reading this was quite exciting.
I bet it was. Maybe a little scary, too.
And a little scary. So when I came to surrealism, which was by way of David Bowie, actually.
Wait, David Bowie, the British pop star?
The British pop star. I was a big fan of his. And he started, you know, dropping the name Salvador Dali and I know and whatnot in his interviews. So he put me on a track to start looking for this thing called surrealism. And then I discovered not only surrealism through Salvador Dali and René Magritte in the visual arts, but also I discovered that the Icelandic modernist poetry that had transformed Icelandic poetry overnight after the Second World War, it all had its roots in surrealism. And yes, being trained on the Icelandic folk stories, coming to surrealism was somehow the natural thing to do.
Are you unusual for an Icelander to find these connections between surrealism and the old folk stories, or is this sort of a common thing in Iceland?
There was something with my generation. We were not only influenced by surrealism, but we were also the kids who embraced punk music when it happened. And with punk, you had anarchism, and yes, you had like the big world knocking on our doors again, you know, with this new type of aggressive rock and roll. But right from the beginning, we were all somehow aware of the fact that this was not only exciting for its own sake, it was also an opportunity to discover new tools to deal with the old reality of Iceland.
I love this, sort of this combination of punk music, surrealism, and Icelandic sagas, somehow getting all mixed up in the same pot.
Yes. And, you know, you mentioned the word magic realism. In Iceland, we've always said, you know, that when magic realism became, you know, a new world literary style, you know, we just leaned back and said, yes, we've been there. You know, that's what we were doing in the 14th century. So, but it's nice to see how they're dealing with it in Latin America.
Yeah, you didn't have to read those Latin American writers from the 1960s. It had been around for a few centuries before.
Yes. But then on the other hand, when we discovered the Latin American authors, it was a reminder of that tradition. Because in between, realism had more or less taken over in Icelandic letters. And that was one of the things we were also challenging. You know, we were also challenging, you know, realism. And it was very handy to be able to say, when we are using surrealism, when we employ the tricks that we've learned from García Márquez or whoever, we are being traditional. We are using the same tools that the poets of the 9th century even were using.
So what didn't you like about the more realistic tradition in, let's say, literature? What were you reacting against?
What I was reacting against was the boredom of it. Much of the realism that we were served in the 70s, for example, was the so-called social realism that we had imported from, I think, from Sweden mainly and the other Scandinavian countries. And these stories, they were about the mundane, they were about the everyday life. You were supposed to understand the life of women working in a cannery much better if you read these books. But they lacked all blood, they lacked all excitement. So for teenagers, this was hopeless reading material, you know. So we really reacted against the boredom of the everyday life. And we, you know, we just took up the old surrealist flag and said, man is also a dreaming animal. And when you remember that there is so much eroticism in surrealism as well, you got the perfect art movement for teenagers.
Sounds like it, yes. Well, let's talk about some of your novels. From the Mouth of the Whale is one of the books that has been recently translated into English. It's about a 17th century naturalist and writer who was charged with sorcery and then exiled. This character was based on an actual historical figure, wasn't he?
Yes. In the 17th century, there was a man named Jón Lærði Guðmundsson, Jón the Learned Guðmundsson, who was all those things. You know, he was a woodcarver, he was a painter, he carved things out of bone. Yes, he was a natural historian. He was even an exorcist, but his biggest crime, his big crime was actually the fact that he was good natured and curious. And in the times that followed the Reformation in Iceland, there was very little space for free thought. The Lutheran Church became very draconic. It more or less killed music. No secular music. Secular music was allowed. Dancing was banned. Everything to do with the old religion and the old—I mean, with Catholicism, of course—but also everything to do with the old Nordic pantheon was forbidden. And this was a guy who was really trying to be a scientist, and a lover of poetry. And in those times, it really just gave him nothing but trouble.
So, what he was considered in league with the devil then, and then exiled.
Yes, his interest in, for example, runes, the old alphabet of the Vikings, was considered very suspicious. And also his knowledge of herbs and plants, which he used for healing, that was also seen as something very suspicious. So these were really dark times in Iceland. But he was not only very curious, he was also he also had the urge to share his knowledge. So whenever he heard about a plant that could be used to help a woman in labor or an animal, let's say conches, he discovered that conches can be eaten and can be used as hallucinogens, actually.
Conches? You mean the seashell?
The seashells, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you could try it even, you know. I mean, they're legal. So you could eat a pot of conches and you would have some strange experiences. Well, anyway, he was always trying to share what he had learned. And this put him into trouble. So he was always up against all the authorities. But his biggest crime was that he actually reported on the massacre of whalers, Basque whalers who came to Iceland in the second decade of the 17th century.
Wait, in the massacre not just of the whales, but of the people who actually
of the people. There were Basque whalers.
Huh.
There were Basque whalers who came to Iceland and set up whaling stations. These were quite cultured people. And great citizens of the Basque country, the captains of these ships, but because of the political situation in Iceland and the prejudices against foreigners, and especially Catholic foreigners, these people were massacred in the most brutal manner, and the poor guy, he reports on this quite accurately and unsentimentally. And in a piece that has been called the first instance of investigative journalism, actually, in Iceland.
Hmm.
So he was everywhere, and wherever he went, he got himself into trouble. But his world was rich, and what I tried to do in the book is that I tried to recreate the mind of somebody living in those times.
One of the pleasures of reading this novel is there are all of these scientific observations of strange creatures like the sea speckle and the red poison needle. And in your novel, some of these creatures seem to have magical powers.
Yes, that's the thing. I mean, natural science in those days was not only about describing the phenomena as accurately as possible. You also brought everything you knew about the plant or the stone with it, you know. So let's say if you wrote about a cat, you did not only write about the cat as a creature. If you knew a story about a ship that had been named the Cat, you would also tell the story of the ship named Cat along with this. And then, of course, you would also tell about all the possible supernatural abilities of that animal. So it was quite a lovely science and lively science, and one of the pleasures of writing that book was to take a seat in the mind of somebody living in those times, and to view the world with his eyes, and to be able to write with utter conviction things that we know are absolutely wrong, but were maybe beautiful.
I
want to tell you one example, because which is from natural science. Natural scientists were desperate because they couldn't classify nature. So they were desperately looking for new means and for the right ways of classifying nature, how to structure their natural museums. And one scientist, for example, proposed that the bumblebee and the rat were sisters. They were practically very related animals.
The bumblebee and the rat?
Yes, and why? Because both have short hair, you know. So they were looking for all these possibilities. And for a surrealist poet, you know, this is just, surrealism in motion.
Right. Well, you seem to be very attracted to this pre-Enlightenment world? I mean, sort of that period in history right before science and rationality came to shape our understanding of the world.
Yes, because in a way, it was the world was still open to interpretation. The world was still open also to the layman to have his guess at what the world is made of. And then we had the Enlightenment, and the world was all of a sudden a fixed thing, a fixed system of solar systems and galaxies and everything. And that's why I'm actually very happy to be living in the times we are living in now, because the old understanding that everything in the world is made of a prima materia, the original material, that everything comes from this primal matter, and that everything and therefore everything has the ability to turn into everything else. This understanding of the world is returning to us with our understanding of genes. Because now we know that there is actually this prima materia called the genes. And with their manipulation, almost everything can become everything else. It's possible to have a human being growing a tail. You know,
somehow creating a hybrid between a rat and a bumblebee. I don't know.
There you go. And I'm sure somebody's already working on it.
So is this part of your project then as a novelist to create a believable world? I mean, believable to the reader out of, I don't know what you would call it, different cosmologies, sort of entirely different ways of seeing things, but somehow to put that into one narrative that hangs together?
Yes, very much, and I like to enjoy the fact and to play with the fact that cosmologies are not constant. Cosmologies are always something to be discussed. The cosmology of the Greeks, which is to be found in the Whispering Muse, is different from the cosmology of the learned man in From the Mouth of the Whale. It's also different from the world of the herbalist in The Blue Fox. But these are all believable cosmologies. They are all the given cosmologies in each period. So I like to bring different cosmologies together in play, or to use them to challenge each other. But it's really wonderful to think that the biggest truths of each period of time, the cosmologies, they are not constant. They are constantly changing.
You know, listening to you and sort of describing your philosophy of not just of fiction, but of how to make sense of what's real, I think I now understand why you collaborate with Björk, for instance, on her recent Biophilia album, which is really about the wonders of nature and the connection between art and science. And you wrote, lyrics for three of the songs on that album?
Yes. And I think actually the Biophilia project is in many ways close to From the Mouth of the Whale. Because in The Mouth of the Whale, you have a scientist. I mean, the man is a scientist. And he is using his science and his poetic imagination to make sense of nature and to place himself within nature. So, I you're right. I think Björk and I mean, we really share this belief in man's need to interact with nature through science and through poetry and through music.
Well, I'm wondering if you are both animists in some way. I mean, do you see life in all parts of the universe, even those things that we would normally consider inanimate?
One of the things that actually brought me to the story of the scientist in From the Mouth of the Whale was an article I read by André Breton. So here you have surrealism again. Mm-hmm. An article André Breton wrote about the Swiss alchemist, doctor, physicist, Paracelsus. And Paracelsus had the belief that everything is alive. Even stones are alive. But no man will live to tell the story of a stone or witness, let's say, the dance of a stone. Because stones dance very slowly.
That is wonderful. And do you think Björk shares that sensibility?
Yes. She dances like a stone, a little bit faster, though.
Well, probably your best-known novel is The Blue Fox, which is set in the late 19th century, and it's a story about several things, but partly about a priest who becomes obsessed with hunting a rare and magical fox. Now, was this story inspired by any Icelandic folk stories?
Yes. Yes, I think you can say so, because the Icelandic fox hunter is a very peculiar creature, even more peculiar than the fox itself. When I came across an anthropological study of the Icelandic fox hunters, I instantly realized that there was something there for me to work with. Because the Icelandic fox hunter has all these incredible beliefs in the powers of the fox. And everything that I describe in the book, how the fox takes over the mind of the fox hunter, how the fox steers the fox hunter this direction and that, plays with his feelings makes him hallucinate and I don't know what. All these are based on true and accurate descriptions by real fox hunters. So this is what set me, you know, that this is what got me going with that novel. You know, I started it as a novel about this fox hunt, but when I discovered at the end of the chapter, that this fox hunter was a priest, I realized that I had a much bigger story than just the story of a fox hunt. And by then I had come to realize that this priest was maybe not the easiest person to live with. So I thought, okay, this guy is a sort of a tyrant in his tiny valley somewhere. He lords over his congregation. So let's find a nemesis for him. And by a coincidence, I came up on a photograph taken by a French photographer traveling around Iceland in the 19th century. And in this photograph, there was a young man standing in front of a turf house, which is one of these houses which practically look like grassy hills with doors and windows. Except this man, he stood in front of this house, and he was dressed impeccably. He was dressed in a suit and a vest, and had a nice big cravat, and a wonderful moustache. So he practically looked as if he had stepped out of a cafe in France. Absolutely misplaced. So I thought this man could be the nemesis for the primitive fox hunting clergyman. And that's how I started looking for an opportunity for a dispute between those two men. Mm. And that led me to the story of Abba, the girl with Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. Who is rejected by one and sheltered by the other.
Yeah.
So this is how stories, you know, I mean, when you're, I'm a hunter of stories, you know. I'm always listening for good stories and opportunities to use my craft. And, you know, how it is, one story begets another.
Yeah. Well, near the end of The Blue Fox, the priest shoots the fox, but then gets buried in an avalanche, and it looks like he's going to die. And you have this lovely passage, which I want to read. On the fifth day, the priest under the glacier began to fear for his sanity. So he did what comes most naturally to an Icelander when he is in a fix, that is to recite ballads, verses, and rhymes, sing loud and clear to himself, and when all else fails, to recall his hymns. This is a fail-safe old trick if men wish to preserve their wits. It's a great passage, but I guess I have to wonder, do Icelanders really do this?
Yeah, those of us who really wish to preserve our wits. There is always the other option, you know. Yes, well, yes, it's in a nutshell, it is a description of what you do to survive on a small island in the north of the Atlantic, surrounded by the cold sea. To keep your wits, you the only thing you have is stories and poetry.
Hmm. So why do folk tales and folk beliefs have such staying power, especially in Iceland?
Well, I actually think folk stories have a staying power everywhere. And I truly believe that man should first and foremost be defined as a storytelling animal. Our need to hear stories, to share stories, seems to be a primal need. Many of the stories that are disguised as contemporary novels today are really just flexed out versions of stories that have stayed with us for thousands of years. For example, the story of the three wishes. Somebody gets three wishes.
Mm-hmm.
This is at the heart of so many contemporary novels.
Hmm.
Somebody is faced with three challenges. And through these three challenges, this person discovers him or herself, you know, either as a fool or as a noble person. So folk stories are really at the heart of all the stories we're telling all the time. In the news now, you have a very sad case of a story of an ogre who enslaves young women, young maiden.
Right.
You know, these stories are real. Luckily, most of the time, they only take place in oral tellings and or paper. But these sad instances, when they become real, they also remind us that they have always been with us. And one of the ways to deal with the fact that they are true is to keep telling those stories.
So if these old stories are still with us, are the old gods also still with us?
Obviously, the old gods never left. I had an experience with this. In 2004, Björk and I were asked to write the opening song for the Olympics. And that year, the Olympics returned to Greece, to Athens. So we were in Athens, and one day we went on a trip south of Athens to a peninsula where an old temple to Poseidon is sitting on a cliff. And obviously, this is one of these old temples that is in ruins. And I remember as we got closer to the temple, I thought to myself, oh, look at the state you are in, old Poseidon. Look at the ruins of your temple. Where are you now? Where is your glory? Because this is how Icelandic poets think when they're traveling. So, but then we got close to the temple and I walked to the edge of the cliff. And who greeted me there? Poseidon. Poseidon was still there in all his glory. The blue ocean was still there, sitting at the edge of the cliff, still close to his temple. So it reminded me that the old gods are really names for the great natural elements that are always bigger than man.
Hmm.
And then, of course, we had the biggest reminder of the power of these gods when the tsunami struck in Indonesia. That's where Poseidon, who had been lying so peacefully in Greece, reminded us what happens if he just like raises his little finger.
Hmm.
So the gods are still here, yes.
Yeah. I want to talk briefly about the other novel that's just been translated into English, The Whispering Muse, which is about an aging man who ends up on a Danish cargo ship. And one of the crew members on this boat is Kainos, the figure from the ancient Greek myths. He was a crew member on Jason's ship, the Argo. So he was one of the Argonauts, you know, looking for the Golden Fleece. And it turns out he's a wonderful storyteller. And so here you are. You have this story set kind of in the modern world. And this guy who was an Argonaut on Jason's ship is telling this, you know, remarkable, strange, weird story of, you know, being stranded on a bewitched island only with women. And you're somehow bringing these two things together, and it totally works. And what made you think that you could kind of pull off writing a story that was about Greek myth with kind of modern times?
Well, it grew out of the necessity to find a storyteller strong enough, with a tale big enough to actually shut up the old guy. Because the old guy is obsessed with his theories about the relationship between fish consumption and the superiority of the Nordic race. And he's got no time for anything else, you know. He closes his ears to all other stories. So I thought, I really have to bring a master storyteller from the ancient world, a master storyteller telling one of the big, epic narratives that make up Western culture. And because the old man is so self-obsessed, it somehow gave me the possibility of having him listening to Caenus, telling this tale without ever asking the question, the obvious question, that it should be impossible that you sit down at the captain's table every night with a 4,000-year-old man. You know. And that was the challenge for that book. That was the challenge, you know. And I'm glad to hear that you feel it works.
No, it totally works, yeah. Well, some people say that the modern world has become disenchanted as people have lost their faith in religion, as science has become the new intellectual orthodoxy. Do you see your fiction as an attempt to re-enchant the world?
Yes, I think the worldview in those books asks us to remember that we live in an enchanted world, that our world is not one thing. Our world is made up of many different things. And just the fact that we dream every night is a reminder that we live in an enchanted world. We live in a world, yes, where we are taken places that have nothing to do with the scientific view of it. We are every night we are taken to a world of symbols and meanings and emotions and strange happenings, and this can also be done when you open a book, when you read a book, then you're also taken to a place like that. So we live in an enchanted world, you know. There are strange stories everywhere, you know. And I think most people, I actually think most people are quite happy to acknowledge that the world is a bit strange.
I think you're right. Thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you.